Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Investors are a fickle bunch. They'll even tell you that about themselves. So maybe we shouldn't have been too surprised that once the immediate crisis in the financial sector passed, they would find something else to worry about. Today, it was pharmaceuticals. Lousy earnings, a problem with a big clinical trial, and a takeover bid that might not be big enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us today, everybody. It's Monday, the 21st of July. And we'll start at the beginning of the day's news with that takeover bid. In biotechnology, Genentech is the stuff of legend. 30 years ago, the California startup was among the first to use genetic engineering to make medicines, and make those medicines it did. Last year, the three best-selling cancer drugs in this country all carried the Genentech label on them. But today's development might mark the end of the startup era in next-generation medicine. The Swiss pharmaceutical giant Roche wants to buy the 44% of Genentech it doesn't already own. But Genentech's not going to come as cheap as Roche is hoping, if the deal even goes down at all. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Roche offered $89 a share for Genentech stock, but that may not be enough. Analyst Jason Zhang at BMO Capital Markets says Roche may have to offer more than $100 a share if it really wants Genentech. And there are big reasons for Roche to really want it. According to IMS Health, Genentech's top cancer drug had sales of over $2 billion last year. Roche has the right to license any of Genentech's new drugs, but that option expires in 2015. Also, Zhang says a full merger would be more efficient.
They could streamline a lot of the research and save cost.
But the savings will only accrue if Roche can keep the same culture of creativity that makes Genentech such a standout. The company gives its employees lots of independence. Jay Markowitz is an analyst at T. Rowe Price.
The biggest concern about this transaction, should it go through, is how Roche would retain the tremendous people that has made it such a successful and innovative biotech company.
It seemed to work the first time Roche bought into Genentech. Editor David Hamilton at BNet Industries says even though Roche owns 56% of Genentech, it doesn't even hold a majority of board seats.
They don't tell Genentech what to do. Obviously, if they buy the whole company, that is quite likely to change.
Genentech will leave the fated decision to a board of independent directors. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Just to finish out today's Marketplace Pharmaceutical Roundup, Schering Plough reported earnings today after the bell. Ordinarily, I wouldn't mention that timing, but the company pushed its report past the close so the market could absorb some disheartening news about its cholesterol drug Vytorin. Apparently, it doesn't work the way it's supposed to, no better than a placebo in a big European study. Those earnings, by the way, down, but still better than expected. One can only wonder how they do what they do, but Food and Drug Administration investigators have done the epidemiological equivalent to finding a needle in a haystack. The FDA announced today it's found the same strain of salmonella responsible for the recent tomato ban in a single Mexican-grown jalapeno pepper in a processing plant down in Texas. But the agency said it's still not ready to say exactly what the source of the outbreak is. Once you're clear what's safe to eat and what's not, get ready for some more sticker shock at the supermarket. We're learning that food companies can't eat the costs of more expensive ingredients and fuel anymore, and they're about to raise prices again by a lot. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the latest on food inflation.
Sara Lee makes Jimmy Dean sausages. It says prices on meat products could rise up to 20% by the end of the year. Kraft Foods has signaled that prices for some of its cheeses could jump 25%.
The packaged food companies continue to be hit with rising commodity costs, and as a result, they have been, as a group, passing those increased costs on to consumers through rising prices.
That's equity analyst Aaron Swanson with Morningstar. Between the weak economy and higher food prices, they're up 5% in the past year. Consumers are cutting back. Swanson says that's been hard on food companies that sell to restaurants and grocery stores.
In their food service business, they'd seen that business shrink, meaning that people were favoring eating at home versus eating out.
So far, grocery stores have been reluctant to pass along big price increases to consumers. Economist Ephraim Liebtag is with the Agricultural Department's Economic Research Service. He says shoppers will be paying more for beef, pork, and poultry.
In terms of going forward, end of this year into 2009 as well, we're going to see higher meat prices because a lot of the corn that is produced in this country goes towards animal feed, and that takes a few more months to kind of get through the system.
Liebtag expects the price of beef will increase 6 to 7% next year. As meat prices rise, analysts expect consumers will increasingly find substitutes for what's for dinner. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On the topic of things getting more expensive, remember the gas tax holiday that was in the news a couple of months back? John McCain wanted to give drivers a break by suspending the 18.5 cents a gallon federal gas tax. Still does, in fact. Hillary Clinton said she was in favor. Barack Obama said he wasn't. Anyway, Congress never did anything about it. And in fact, now the talk on Capitol Hill is about raising the gas tax. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington.
The gas tax fills up the Highway Trust Fund, which pays for the nation's transportation infrastructure. But the gas tax hasn't gone up since 1993, despite rising costs for construction and cars that get better mileage. As a result, the fund faces a $3 billion deficit next year, its first ever. Jeff Soulsby with the American Road and Transportation Builders Association says that means job losses, first and foremost in road construction.
If nothing is done to address the looming highway trust fund shortfall coming October 1st, you're looking at in the neighborhood of 486,000 jobs at jeopardy when states are immediately impacted with a 34% across-the-board cut in federal funding sent to states.
Job losses resonate on Capitol Hill. After all, the only thing as scary as raising taxes for a politician is a bunch of angry unemployed voters. In the short term, Congress may pitch in money from general tax revenues to fill the gap. As for the long term, there are a number of unpleasant options. Jeff Urema, who's helping Congress develop solutions for the Highway Trust Fund dilemma, says there could be increases in tolls, a vehicle miles traveled fee, and/or a higher gas tax.
It is the most conventional outcome. And because it's conventional, I suspect it will get very serious consideration.
But Urema says even a gas tax hike would be like putting a Band-Aid on a deep wound, because down the road, we'll still be driving, but we almost certainly won't be using as much gas to do it. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oil snapped its four-day slide today, bumped up a little more than $2 after some drilling platforms in the Gulf of Mexico were evacuated to prepare for Tropical Storm Dolly. Crude closed at $131.04 a barrel in New York. Equity investors couldn't quite make up their minds for most of the day, and when they finally did, the mood was to the downside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wall Street gave Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a split decision today. Fannie was up, Freddie was down. But their gains last week relieved some of the pressure for Congress to act on the Bush administration's bailout plan for the two mortgage giants. Leaders on the Hill are set to bring the bill up for debate and a vote later this week. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has been covering the story for us in Washington. Hi, John.
Hello, Kai.
Congress has before it this housing bill. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Fed want some things out of Congress. Remind us what they want, would you?
Yeah, those two are asking for an unlimited amount of money to do whatever it takes to guarantee Fannie and Freddie's loans. A temporary authority, it would last for 18 months. But they are hoping that an overwhelming commitment by the government, essentially making Fannie and Freddie's loans as safe as Treasury securities, will restore the market's trust in mortgages and mean the government will never have to use any of the backstop.
But anybody who goes to Congress and says we need unlimited anything probably doesn't have much luck, do they? What's Congress's response been?
Exactly. Especially Republicans. They're opposed to giving Treasury and the Fed a blank check for an unlimited bailout. So congressional negotiators are trying to work out some accountability, some limit to taxpayers' exposure. Otherwise, you know, a total collapse of Fannie and Freddie could add tens of billions, even hundreds of billions of dollars to the national debt.
What about more regulations, though, of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Is that going to happen?
Yes, I think so. That's another part of the accountability here. Perhaps higher capital requirements to cover the mortgages that Fannie and Freddie bundle and sell to the markets. As we've reported, Fannie and Freddie have capital on hand that's equal to less than 2% of the loans they guarantee, and that's a lot less than the requirements on regular banks. Also, Congress is likely to require tougher standards on borrowers to make sure that they really do have the ability to pay back these mortgages.
You pointed out, John, that some members of Congress, Republicans specifically, gave the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed a tough time about this request when they were up on the Hill last week. What's the White House going to do about it? What's their reaction?
Well, they are threatening a veto, mainly because of an article that was from the original bill, a $4 billion in block grants to help the government buy foreclosed properties. And the White House is saying that's too much money, too much intervention in a private market.
So what's going to happen by the end of the week, John? They've said they want it done and out and on the president's desk.
That's right, by the end of the week. And that's a pretty tall order given the uncertainties that are in this bill. There's still lots of backroom negotiating. But if there's a sense of an emergency, Congress and the administration could pull this off. They don't want to be the ones to blame for a delay that could cause a panic here and abroad and a possible collapse of credit markets.
And really, all it takes for that sense of urgency is a couple of bad days in the stock market for Fannie and Freddie, no?
Exactly. And they had some trouble auctioning off some debt today, so that puts the pressure on them.
John Dimsdale in Washington. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kai.
Not too long ago, you could find young hipsters in coffee bars, knitting away at shawls and berets. Yarn shops were popping up in fashionable neighborhoods, and 20-somethings were organizing knitting circles. But it looks like the fad has passed, because those still in the market for needles and yarn are buying most of their wares online. And Carolyn Adolph reports that has some of those knitting stores spinning a sad tale.
Davis, California had two yarn shops. They were stacked to the rafters with quality yarn. 3 years ago, shops like these were full of knitters. Now they're gone. Maria Inglesby closed her Davis yarn shop last September.
So this is Bombix Mori, but do you see the colors?
Can I spin that?
Yes, you can spin that.
Now she sells yarn from her house. She says she knew knitting would fall out of fashion, but not this fast.
The sales were dropping rather rapidly, and when we are sitting in an area where we have an economic contraction and where people are facing debt that they need to take care of, they're not going to invest into yarn. They're not going to invest into a hobby.
The irony is, knitting's boom was actually born in a recession, the one after 9/11. Worried women knit. The National Needleworkers Association says yarn sales grew by 40% a year. Unheard of. That run-up peaked in 2005. At first, there was business for everyone. A lot of neighborhood stores opened up, and a quarter of sales moved to the internet. Then customers lost interest. Some yarn shops are finding a way to survive. Laura and Doug Zander will tell you it's a lot of work. They own Jimmy Bean's Wool, a shop in a strip mall in Reno, Nevada. 80% of their business is now online. Jimmy Bean's Wool isn't just another internet retailer. It's a virtual knitting shop with online tutorials and a toll-free number for human advice. Now they have reviews of knitting gear on YouTube.
Hi, I'm Laura from Jimmy Bean's Wool, and I am reviewing the Offhand Designs Zhivago Weekender Bag.
Laura Zander says her online customers are busy people. No time for knitting lessons and no time to shop.
How many people are doing video reviews of products? We had people who just said it makes you feel like you're in the store.
Zander says she pulls internet clients from New York City and Chicago, where women have big jobs and no time.
If they order it on Saturday, they'll get it on Monday, you know, and the shipping is flat rate $4, and then no sales tax. Once they see all of those benefits, then we've got a returning customer.
That's the go big formula. But are there small-scale business models that work? Maria Inglesby is trying something new. She travels to where the customers are by running knitting circles. She still tracks down quality yarn for her clients. Now she's paid for her expertise as well. At a cafe in Davis, a dozen women gather around her, and one entire table wants to know how to stitch the end of a sock.
We need to flip this puppy around.
In Davis, California, I'm Carolyn Adolph for Marketplace.
Coming up, the truth about hidden political piggy banks.
That's going to fund their ability to go to the Super Bowl and have a party. That's going to fund their ambition to move up in Congress and, if the ambition's to be president, to fund that as well.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 0.25% today, 29 points to close at 11,467. The NASDAQ dribbled down 0.1%, 3 points to close at 2279. The S&P 500 slid 0.1% as well, 1 point, ended at 1259. Drug companies led the news today. As I mentioned, Genentech got a shot in the arm on that merger news we told you about earlier. Shares popping up nearly 15%. Merck and Schering Plough both looked sickly after they released bad news about their cholesterol drug Vytorin. Merck dropped 6%. Schering Plough fell off more than 11%. Bank of America raised investor spirits early in the session when it reported better-than-expected earnings. The stock jumped almost 4% today. American Express, though, lost 3% as investors awaited earnings news from the credit card company. They reported lower second-quarter earnings after the close, saying delinquencies on its cards are creeping higher as the economy continues to falter. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.05%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, BP founder T. Boone Pickens testifies on energy security before the Senate Homeland Security Committee. The Foundation for Child Development and the New American Foundation released the annual Child Well-Being Index. It measures the quality of life for kids in the U.S. And the man behind the voice of Nemo celebrates his birthday. Comedian Albert Brooks turns 61. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Activist shareholder and sometime corporate raider Carl Icahn has decided to settle for second best. Earlier this morning, Icahn and Yahoo announced a deal to end Icahn's attempt to get rid of that company's board of directors. Instead, he and a couple of friends will get seats on Yahoo's board, which puts a stop, for now at least, to Icahn's efforts to sell the company to Microsoft. And it leaves Microsoft still trying to figure out how to get a real toehold in the world of internet advertising. We're talking a pretty lucrative toehold here, too. One industry study says $21 billion was spent advertising online last year. Almost half of that money went to search engines, those ads that appear after you run a search. Google's got the lion's share of that market. But commentator and economist Ian Ayers says thanks to new programs from Microsoft and others, you too can get in on the action.
We expect internet services to be free. It's almost an inalienable right. A site like Google provides us incredibly useful information and charges us nothing for the service. But now Microsoft goes one better in this limbo game of how low can you go. Its new cashback program will actually pay you to search the web, provided you ultimately buy the item. But the next step is for a search company to start paying consumers for clicking whether or not they make a purchase. Why would a company like Microsoft or Google be willing to share any of its ad revenue? For one, they believe the cash incentive will encourage more of us to use that search service. On the internet, eyeballs are valuable commodities. Advertisers sometimes pay Google more than $50 per click to have their ad pop up after particularly valuable search terms like free insurance quote. An advertiser who's willing to compensate you for clicking through is putting its money where its mouth is, that you're going to find its ad worthwhile. Of course, under this system, some consumers will be tempted to click and close just so that they can cash in on the compensation. Hackers will even be tempted to set up bots to search and click compensated ads. But advertisers have easy ways to limit this abuse. They can cut off your compensation if you develop a history of clicking through without ever purchasing. Advertisers spend millions on print ads, and they get far less information about whether we read, much less buy, based on the ad. Compensated ad consumption could even expand beyond the internet. It could also help redeem television ads. TiVo and Google TV have the technology today to start compensating viewers who watch particular commercials live or even after the fact. Imagine it, a world where advertisers paid you for your time.
Ian Ayers is a professor at the Yale Law School. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. The presidential race is getting most of the press this election cycle. Last time round, though, control of Congress was in the balance. And that November, after the Democrats won, Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi had this to say.
The American people voted to restore integrity and honesty in Washington, D.C.
Pelosi was, of course, by no means the first to say her party would change the way Washington does business. Before her, it was Newt Gingrich, and before him, countless others. None of them managed to actually change the culture of ethics in the nation's capital, though. Lawmakers are still dining out and jetting off on trips they don't pay for themselves and taking friends and lobbyists with them. They get the money to do that not through their campaign accounts, but by setting up something called a Leadership Political Action Committee, or PAC. Today, in part one of our series, PAC Men, Marketplace's Steve Henn explains how they work and why.
Just a few blocks from the Capitol is another Washington institution, Bistro Bees.
Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Congressional lawmakers flock to this restaurant, and sitting at a little table, it's easy to see why.
What about appetizers?
Appetizers, personal favorites. I love the duck liver parfait. I always recommend the quenelles, which are the scallop mousse dumplings, served with a little bit of the lobster bisque. Another thing they do very well here.
And then the waiter shows me the wine list.
2006 vintage, shows nice spice, full-bodied Pinot Noir, very unique. Does that fit in your price range, or are we looking for something like
$86 is probably a little bit above our price range, okay. Roughly twice.
But these prices aren't a deterrent for powerful Democrats like Charlie Rangel and Ted Kennedy, or Republicans like Roy Blunt and Trent Lott. They came to Bistro Bees frequently last year. Sometimes it was for fundraisers, sometimes it was just lunch. And often, their leadership political action committees picked up the tab.
It's like having a little cash register, a little bank account at their beck and call.
Meredith McGeehee at the Campaign Legal Center says rules about leadership PACs are incredibly loose.
Under the federal statute and under FEC regulation, there is no restriction on using leadership PACs for personal use.
That wasn't the original intent. The idea for congressional PACs came from their corporate and union cousins. Congress allows corporate and union PACs to raise money for candidates they favor. Lawmakers copied it as a way to raise money and share it with their friends' campaigns. But virtually no rules governing these new congressional PACs were ever passed. Tony Coelho founded his 30 years ago as a young congressman from Modesto, California, looking to be somebody on Capitol Hill.
At that point, it gave me an opportunity to give people, my colleagues, or challengers, a check that they weren't used to getting from members of Congress. So if you only had 15 PACs from members of Congress, and you were one of the 15, all of a sudden, you were somebody special, and I knew that.
Coelho became somebody special indeed. He quickly rose through the ranks and became the third most powerful Democrat in Congress. And it didn't hurt that PACs weren't obvious to the public. Lawmakers had to report PAC spending to the Federal Election Commission, but they didn't have to disclose that they actually ran one.
Basically, it was just you raised and you reported. There was nothing, no restrictions to a great extent.
And almost 30 years later, there still aren't. Here's how it works. Lawmakers ask lobbyists and other special interests to donate money to their PACs. And then lawmakers can spend it almost any way they want, donating to their party or colleagues, or using their PAC as a catch-all for other things. McGeehee says that makes leadership PACs too tempting to pass up, especially since Congress just passed new ethics rules that ban lobbyists or corporations from paying directly for lawmakers' meals and trips.
If they have money in that leadership PAC, that's going to fund their ability to go to the Super Bowl and have a party. That's going to fund their ambition to move up in Congress and, if the ambition's to be president, to fund that as well.
According to FEC records, last year politicians used their PACs, funded by lobbyists and special interests, to pay for more than $2 million in meals and trips to golf resorts.
the end result is they get to eat at some of the best restaurants in town and have somebody else foot the bill, lobbyists and others included.
In Tony Coelho's day, there were just 15 leadership PACs. Today, there are 350 run by politicians, including governors and current and former members of Congress. Marketplace spent 6 months combing through FEC PAC filings to piece together who runs what PAC and how those PACs spend their money. These accounts raised more than $400 million since 2000 and gave away just $150 million to candidates running in elections, according to FEC reports. That means more than 60% of the money went for fundraising overhead and staff. Charities like the Red Cross try to spend just half that percentage on overhead. And in fact, in the last 3 years, politicians have spent more than $25 million from these accounts to pay for travel and perks, including golf and skiing trips with lobbyists, chartered jets, fundraising parties, limos, dining out, and other luxuries. And all of these expenses are legal. It's just part of how business gets done in the nation's capital. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
If you want to see how your lawmaker spends his or her PAC money, we've got a searchable database online. It's at our website, marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can hear other stories in our series. We call it Pac-Man.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a reminder to be careful what you say when you're talking about the credit squeeze. There's a fairly well-known banking analyst out there named Dick Beauvais. You've heard him on the program a couple of times, I'm sure. A few weeks ago, he did what analysts do. He published a research report about banks, which ones are in trouble and which ones aren't. His timing probably could have been better, though. It was dated July 13th, just after the government had taken over IndyMac. And it was titled, Who's Next? Bank Atlantic down in Florida didn't appreciate being on that list. It's suing Beauvais for negligence and defamation. Beauvais is refusing to comment on advice of his lawyers. My comment is this. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 29 points, a quarter of 1%. The Nasdaq rolled down 3 points. That's about a 10th percent. The S&P 500 shook off 1 point. That's a 10th percent there as well. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, raising the curtain on some unusual political fundraisers.
It is what I would call a burlesque show where there's a woman who comes out and has a dress on. She never gets naked.
That's from the second part of our series, Pac-Man. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I hope you can join us for it tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.